Welcome everyone who's either joining us live or listening to this recording. This is the last office hours session for Mises Academy, Austrian Economics 1, Praxeology through Price Theory. And we finally finished the course. This is the final office hours session. Just as a note, while people are thinking of questions to ask, if you're taking the class for credit, just a reminder to make sure you don't get mixed up. So this final week, you know, going into next week, so let me just make sure I get the dates right here. So today is the 18th. So from the 19th through Thursday, the 23rd of June, you can do your quiz 8, and then the following week, so the last week of June, you're going to have the final exam that will be over the whole course. Okay, so I will, of course, be sending out emails telling people about the final and giving you the structure and so forth. If you've taken classes from me before, it's going to be very similar. Okay, we've got a question. Benjamin asks, a report on goldnews.com says that the Treasury confiscated the Fed's gold in 1934 and gave them non-tradable gold certificates, which they still have on their books. Is there any condition under which the Fed could place a claim on the Treasury's gold? I don't know, to be honest with you. That stuff is murky, as far as my understanding of it. I mean, that sounds plausible to me. I just came across it the other day. The holdings of the federal government, financial holdings, and they list as one of their assets 261, I think, 0.5 million ounces of gold. And like I said, I'm pretty sure like the way they handle that is that they're saying it's like the Treasury owns it as opposed to the Federal Reserve. So I think you're right. but that is interesting. So I don't know off the top of my head. So if you look at the Fed's assets, are some of the assets gold certificates? And then the other interesting thing is how do they value them? Because the Treasury's gold, they claim they have, I think the number is 261.5 million ounces. If you valued it at market exchange rates, it would be, I just calculated, don't quote me on this figure, but it's like over $350 billion. It might be over $400 billion, depending on what the prices that you're using. But they don't value it anywhere near that amount on their books because they're valuing their gold at $42.2222 per troy ounce of gold. And that, I think they did some hanky-panky back, so it was $35 an ounce. During the Bretton Woods era, and then I think they did something funky where the Nixon administration just like revalued gold when they closed the gold window, just like revalued it and then counted that gain. You know, so the Treasury was holding gold that was at 35 an ounce, and then boom, it went up to 42, and they just counted that as a, you know, like as profit income for the government. I think they used that to suppress what they reported as the deficit that year. I'm pretty sure they did something like that. I mean, I've heard that the Nixon administration was doing all kinds of tricks to make their deficit numbers look lower than they were. So to answer your question, Benjamin, I don't know legally speaking what the Fed could do with that. And there are, of course, a lot of cynics who think that they don't even have that gold at all. You know, whoever's supposed to own it, wherever it is, they're saying. A lot of people say that the Fed or the Treasury, whoever you want to say, is given the legal authority to do this. They'll like actually lease the gold out to some outside firm that then sells it in the market to suppress the gold price. But they don't tell anyone they did that. And so like they're saying that if you actually went, and that's partly why Ron Paul wants to audit the gold. It's because a lot of people are saying that the gold is not there anymore. They used it to suppress the price of gold, and now they actually don't own it. Okay, Benjamin says, here is a tweet from Bill Gross. Gross says, QE3 likely to take the form of, quote, extended period, unquote, language, or interest rate caps on 2-3 year treasuries. And then I guess this is Benjamin now asking, aren't interest rate caps the same thing as potentially unlimited quantitative easing? Considering the amount of debt the U.S. has, how high can the Fed let interest rates go before the debt tsunami crests and causes the ultimate wipeout? Okay, a lot of colorful analogies or metaphors there. All right, well, let's look at the Gross's comment first. So QE3 likely to take the form of extended period language or interest rate caps on 2-3 year treasuries. Okay, so with the extent, I mean, you probably know this, but just to make sure. So with the extended period language, what he's saying is, rather than the Fed committing to an explicit target in terms of monetary injections or purchases the way they have thus far, right? So with QE1 and QE2, the Fed has said, you know, we're going to buy, like with QE2, they said we're going to buy $600 billion worth of treasuries, and here's our timetable. And then with QE1, that kind of came in phases. It depends how you quantify, but that was over $1 trillion worth of stuff if you lump several things together and call that the first round of QE. The other thing, just to make sure people realize this, Bernanke himself doesn't come out and call and say this is QE2, right? That's other people calling it that. So just make sure you realize that Bernanke's not the one calling it the second round of quantitative easing. Okay. So what Gross's comment means is that it's the Fed is not going to, for QE3, this is Gross's opinion, is not going to come out and say, okay, we're going to buy another $800 billion of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, or we're going to buy corporate securities because the stock market's lagging, or so they're not going to do that. He's saying instead they're going to just say, we're going to keep interest rates low for an extended period. And then he's saying specifically they might talk about 2-3 year treasuries and say, we will do whatever we need to do to make sure that those things, you know, the yield on those stays below such and such for an extended period, after which time we will, you know, reevaluate. So the idea is that I think the problem is when the Fed commits to something specific, like a monetary target, like the way they did with QE2, and when I say monetary target, I mean how much base money they're injecting or how much they're expanding their own balance sheet. I don't mean how much is like M2 growing. I think what people are realizing is when the Fed does that, it's sort of like set itself up for defeat, because it's telling people basically, yeah, we're going to put this medicine in and then we're going to pull it out, or we're going to stop injecting it after a certain period, and then people just build their expectations around that, and then if it doesn't work, then it's like they paint themselves into a corner. Then when it starts to unwind, what do people, you know, if the economy's not fixed, what do they do? And then, so I think what Gross is getting at is the Fed's trying to be more strategic and not set itself up for failure like that again. And so they're just going to reassure people and say, this is what the interest rates are going to be like. You can bank on that, rather than us telling you we're going to buy so much stuff. And then once our buying stops, people are going to be wondering, are interest rates going to spike? Because that's what's happening right now, is there's a debate. People are worried that at the end of June, which is, you know, getting really close, are interest rates going to spike because the Fed's going to fall out of the Treasury market? Okay, but now back to Benjamin's question. So he said, are interest rate caps the same thing as potentially unlimited QE? Well, yeah. I mean, they're not the same thing as, but they are potentially unlimited QE, that if interest rates want to go higher than where they set the cap, the only way to to keep them like that is to keep intervening and buying up more and more bonds. I mean, what could ultimately happen is, you know, let's say the rest of the world and even domestic investors realize, oh my gosh, they're just going to keep printing money. Like this isn't something that's going to, we're going to exit gracefully. They're just going to keep printing until we get massive price inflation. You know, maybe it won't happen until 5-6 years out, but what if a lot of people come to that realization and they stop believing Bernanke when he says this is a temporary thing, we're only doing this because we know we can get away with it and not cause big price inflation. The moment we see prices rising, we're going to turn around and stop it on a dime. What if people stop believing him? Just like I never believed him when he said that. What if more and more people start thinking like that? What could happen is the Fed could just start buying the Fed would have to take ownership of every bond that Uncle Sam has ever issued. Right, that's really the ultimate logical stopping point. Because even if the Fed starts buying every bond, every newly issued bond, either, you know, literally at the auction or somebody in the private sector buys it from the Treasury when it's issued, and the Fed buys it right back from them, and so that private sector player is willing to pay more at auction because they know the Fed is sitting right there waiting to buy it. The point is, even if the Fed were only willing to do that, we're only absorbing the current deficits, then if everybody else was convinced that, no, this is, they're just printing money, that's it, that's their solution, prices are going to rise, the dollar's crashing, then interest rates that still wouldn't be enough to suppress interest rates, right? Because everybody would still be wanting to sell their treasury bonds and get rid of them at a lower price. You know, they would just want to get rid of them at any price. And so in order to keep the whole market price up, which is the same thing as keeping interest rates down, you know, tied to those bonds, the Fed would have to step in and buy it from them too, right? So let me just say that again because it was kind of disjointed. The point is, if it became common knowledge and everybody believed that the dollar's done, and the Fed's just going to keep printing money and that's it, at that point, it wouldn't even be enough for the Fed to maintain its interest rate targets for U.S. government debt. It wouldn't even be enough if the Fed just monetized all the new deficits. So when the Treasury, you know, wanted to spend more than it was taking in tax revenue, that it was issuing new bonds, it wouldn't even be enough if the Fed absorbed 100% of them, because people still around the world would be holding previously issued bonds, the, you know, 14-plus trillion in government debt, most, some of that Social Security owns and stuff. But I forget how much is held by everybody, the general public. Okay, but there's a lot. Let's say it's around 10 trillion. I don't remember the exact number. All right, so the Fed would have to monetize all that too, because people would want to be getting rid of it. Other people might be willing to take it, but only at, you know, 8-9% interest rate, let's say. So if the Fed wanted the interest rate to be 2%, the only way that could happen is if the Fed then said to everybody around the world, we'll take all of your Uncle Sam debt and pay you a high price such that the yield is 2%. And so they would start absorbing more than even just the newly issued stuff, depending on how pessimistic the general mood was as to what interest rates were going to do in the U.S. Okay, so there, I mean, in principle, the Fed could make interest rates on U.S. treasuries whatever it wanted, but only if it literally absorbed every last bond issued by the federal government. That's the only way it could do it. If public opinion really turned against it and thought that, oh my gosh, these things, you know, price inflation is coming. So is it going to go that route? I would sure hope not, but who knows what's going to happen. I mean, it could start going down that path, and then maybe they would back off and let interest rates rise. Okay, and then, by the way, for people who are joining us, as always with these office hour sessions, if you have a question, go ahead and post it, because I'm expanding my answers based on how many questions are sitting in the queue. So if you have something, you don't need to wait for me to finish my thought before you post your question. That tells me when it's time to move on. Okay, so Benjamin then also said, considering the amount of debt the U.S. has, how high can the Fed let interest rates go before the debt tsunami crests and causes the ultimate wipeout? Well, I mean, I get what you're saying, but it's kind of like, for me, that would be the good thing, right? If the Fed let interest rates go up. The problem is they're not letting interest rates go up. So for me, the thing that scares me is if Bernanke says what Gross is recommending, that Bernanke comes on and says, yeah, we're going to guarantee that short-term, even like medium-term, 2, 3, 4, 5 year yields on U.S. government debt are going to remain at exceptionally low levels for an extended period. If they come out and say stuff like that, then that's going to really just begin to get another signal that they're going full bore on this, that they're not going to back off. They're going to just keep injecting more and more into the financial sector to try to keep things from blowing up. And that, given my views, that's just going to make it worse. That's going to make the ultimate crash that much harder because they will have pumped in so much more money. So, so you're right. I think what your point is you're saying, suppose the Fed did decide to back off and they say, okay, we got to stop fighting this and just let it collapse. And they, stopped intervening. They froze the size of their balance sheet. What would happen? Yeah, interest rates would start rising. I think the stock market would crash. And then, as interest rates went up, a lot of people who were really leveraged would get caught and they'd go bankrupt. And that's true. But I think the point is that's going to happen at some point. And the longer we keep this illusion going, the more people who are going to get crushed when the day of reckoning comes. And so it's better to do it now, just like it would have been infinitely better had Alan Greenspan just let us suffer the consequences of the dot-com crash rather than pumping in a bunch of money, pushing down interest rates, and fueling the housing bubble. Lewis asks, have I read the post in the general forum about the final exam? No, Lewis, I'm not sure which one you're talking about. It might be quicker if you can just post it in here. I can answer you directly because it might take me a minute to log in and find what you're talking about. Okay, while Lewis is maybe doing that and other people are thinking of other questions, let me just elaborate a little bit on the this end game scenario and so forth. I don't know, Benjamin, is there a magic, maybe this is partly what you're getting at, like is there a magic point at which, oh my gosh, if interest rates went higher than that, everything would blow up, and if they were lower than that, everything would be fine. I don't think there's a magic dividing line like that. I think it's just a spectrum. And again, the sharper the rise in the interest rates, the more painful it would be in the short term. That's true. But remember, it's not that the Fed would be inflicting pain on the economy. It would just be allowing prices to tell the truth. Okay, so it's I don't know if this is a bad analogy or not, but it's like if you had your hand on the stove, and then somebody was giving you like huge injections of painkillers so that you could tolerate your hand being right next to if you weren't literally touching the burner, but your hand was like really close to it, so that your hand was getting cooked, but slowly. And then someone kept shooting up your arm with painkillers and making your arm numb. Somebody might say, well, we can't just keep doing that. This is unsustainable, but the right thing to do would be to stop injecting my arm with painkillers, and then all of a sudden I realize my hand is getting burned and I take my hand away. All right, and that certainly would be painful, and it might be more painful than that 30-second interval than if they had just kept injecting my arm with painkiller. But the point is, I'm doing more and more damage because I'm not getting the feedback. I don't realize what's going on. So the same thing, interest rates are signals. They're how people communicate with each other. They mean something. And so when the Fed is suppressing them and keeping them lower than the market rate would have been, that's distorting things. And so it's not like it's doing the economy a favor by keeping interest rates really low. Okay, so we've got a couple of new questions here. Lewis is asking something, and then I'll just administrative, and then Benjamin's asking something else. Okay, Lewis says, in my post, I was wondering whether it would be possible for the final exam to be on this week instead of waiting up until the last week of June, since we're done with all the readings, I mean. Well, the only problem is I still have to write it, and I'm going out of town. Wednesday, I'm going to Pork Fest, which is that deal up in New Hampshire. So I'm not sure if, excuse me. I mean, for sure, it's got to be available through that week, the last week in June, since I've been telling people that, and they might have been planning on that. But I guess it's conceivable if I got it done in time, I could post it early to let people take it. But I kind of did want to give people a chance to catch up on the reading. That's partly why I give the buffer. Is so, because I know some people, you know, that they're working and they fall behind, and it gives them a chance to get all caught up with the readings or to go back and reread something that didn't make sense on the first pass. So, you know, let me end this suspense. It's not going to happen. Just if this were a regular week and I was in town, I could try to get it written early, but I'm going to be running around getting stuff done before I leave town. I don't think it's going to happen. Okay, Benjamin says, what rate of interest can the government pay on the national debt before defaulting? Okay, right. Yeah, I was wondering if that's what you meant, too, if you didn't mean, like, in terms of private sector players, but you just meant the government. Well, that's – it depends what you mean. I mean, they have tons of revenue coming in. So if they were willing to cut other types of spending, they could pay a lot. They could pay – well, I'm trying to think. I think the last I checked, out of the revenue coming in, only 1/6 of it was necessary for paying interest on the debt. So what does that mean? Does that mean, in theory, interest rates could go up to make the interest payment 6 times bigger and they could still afford to do it? I guess that's what it means. But you're obviously, the government would never get into a situation where all the tax revenue coming in, they just turned around and gave it to bondholders. They would just default before they did that. But would they default if interest rates went up a little bit? I don't think so. So it's the difficulty with this is I don't know how crazy they are. It depends what they want to do. And another thing, too, is they're not all sitting in a room smoking cigars. I mean, there's different people involved, and they have different interests. So, you know, maybe some people would be more conservative and want to say, we can't default, because then that will ruin the credit of the U.S. government. They'll make it harder for us to borrow in the future. So we need to just tighten our belts and get serious right now and make sure we get out of this crisis. Or maybe other people just say, forget it, we got the Fed. Let's just keep printing. So I don't know which faction would dominate if it came down to that. But what I am saying is they do have plenty of leeway. I have an article coming out on Econ Lib. I think it's going to come out next month in July, where I just detailed the liquid assets the federal government has at its disposal. I've written on this stuff before, but for this article I did more research on it to get the exact numbers. And using the government's own figures, their own list of assets and stuff, you could just, looking at just a few things, a few major items, you can get up to $1.6 trillion very quickly. With, like, their the gold they own, if they still had that, the 261.5 million ounces, the what they have, like, $350 billion worth of student loans. They have like $52 billion worth of corporate securities that they still have from TARP. They have dozens of billions that they just list as international reserves, like their IMF claims and special drawing rights, stuff like that. And they have a bunch of oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, and they have a bunch of offshore mineral resources that they could easily auction off to, you know, private companies, or at least auction the rights to develop the resources. So anyway, just doing that and plugging in pretty conservative numbers, I generated a figure that was like $1.6 trillion that they could raise. Now, they couldn't just raise it overnight, because if they tried to sell all that stuff in one day, it would push down the price. But the point is, if they were really serious, like if that was my job and they flew me to Washington and I, you know, got absolution from Walter Block that I was allowed to advise the government, even if they weren't going to shut down completely and I was going to do that, yeah, we could, they could afford to pay higher interest rates and not default. If they just went crazy and slashed, you know, $500 billion from this year's budget and then slashed another $500 billion the next year and that kind of thing, and just started selling off assets like crazy, they could get through it without even running more debt and not default on the existing debt. But the problem is, the reason this stuff is so tricky is that there's actually there's not like a huge budget category of stuff that's just wasteful spending that no one cares about. You know, every major item that the government spends money on, there's interest groups that like it. And sometimes the interest group is like the elderly, you know, people getting Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security. So it's, when you say the government cut spending, it's not like you can do that without fundamentally reforming or changing, because reform sounds like a loaded term, those what's called entitlement programs. So are they willing to do that right now? I don't think so. I think they're going to just muddle through this and just keep going. And then when interest rates rise at some point, I don't know, we'll see, but I think they're just going to print money. That's my guess, because I think there are a group of people who are going to benefit if the dollar, if we switch out of the dollar and switch to something else. So I think they're going to push it. And then I think the people who aren't even thinking that long term, just the short term expediency, yeah, instead of cutting Social Security benefits by 5% across the board, if Bernanke says, no, I can just monetize the debt, we'll do that. I think the politicians will say, okay, do it, Ben, save us. You're our only hope, Ben. Right? So to answer, you know, it's a long roundabout way of getting at your question, but I think there is no magic number of what the interest rate would be. It could go up a lot if they were really serious. If it were a corporation and it had a good business model and the people just said, okay, we just let the spending get out of control these last few decades, but now we're going to get serious and cut the fat and become a lean, mean corporate machine, they could turn it around if you know, the current tax revenues were what their business sales were. But the reason they're in the mess right now is because of the way politics works. So I don't see that they're going to fundamentally change that, especially since, like I say, I think there are a group of people who are partly influencing what's happening that want the dollar to crash at some point, because they want to switch over to a currency that includes, you know, the whole North America. So if that's true, and, you know, I can't prove that, I think that that's plausible based on a lot of the people that are involved in these things, then I'm even less reassured that they're going to do the right thing. Because I think a lot of people assume, even like a lot of free market people who are cynical about the government, they still deep down think, come on, they're not that crazy. It's not in their interest to destroy the dollar. Whereas I'm saying, no, it might be in their interest to destroy the dollar. So so anyway, I'm not optimistic in assuming they're gonna fix it in the end. Okay. Benjamin said, is Bernanke bluffing about acting swiftly to fulfill his mandate for stable prices? Will he really act since it might crash the economy? Okay, so for people who aren't sure, I think what Benjamin's getting at is, like, for example, on his 60 Minutes interview, Bernanke said something, the person said, you know, what's your, I'm paraphrasing here, but what's your degree of confidence that you'll be able to turn this thing around if inflation starts getting out of control? And Bernanke says, 100%, meaning I'm fully confident. There's not a doubt in my mind we can do it. He said, if prices start rising, you know, we have the tools to intervene and turn around like that. I think he snapped his fingers or, you know, something, he or said words to that effect. So there's two problems with that. One is if we did get into a situation where things started getting out of control, it's not obvious to me that Bernanke actually could turn it around unless, I mean, once price inflation starts, if that ever happened, there's nothing he can do. It's possible if we could get to a situation where there's nothing he could do. If they just think, no, that's it, the dollar's dead, even if he, you know, started selling off assets like crazy and shrinking the monetary base, it's possible that people, that wouldn't be enough, if he had lost credibility by that point. The other problem is what Benjamin's getting at there is that Bernanke seems to be assuming, he's going along with the Keynesian analysis here, that the economy's in a rut right now, and that's why we need all this monetary stimulus as well as fiscal stimulus, and we don't need to worry about price inflation so long as there's this huge slack in the economy, that the output gap is really big, the difference between potential GDP and actual GDP. And that so long as unemployment's really high, we don't have to worry about a wage-price spiral where, you know, employees are getting paid more and then they go spend more and that raises prices and then the employee demand raises and it's just a vicious spiral. People are saying, Keynesians are saying, we don't need to worry about that right now because unemployment's so high. So that's why inflation's not an issue. So that's the context in which Bernanke is at answering all these questions, saying he seems to be thinking that if price inflation ever did start getting out of control, if the economy was overheating, to use their metaphors, then he would just raise interest rates and turn things around. But like Benjamin's getting at, what happens if the economy is still awful at that point? What if we have double-digit unemployment at that point, and prices are rising at alarming rates? What's the Fed going to do then? Because if it stops injecting so much money and lets interest rates go up, that's going to cause a short-term crash. And so it's not – Bernanke has never been – he's always answered the question as if that's not a possibility. And I've never heard him say – yeah, even if it meant unemployment going up to 15%, we would do whatever we had to do to make sure prices never rose above 3% year to year or something like that. He's never talked like that because his answer is always couched in the scenario where, oops, we pressed on the gas too hard, now the economy's overheating, and we overshot, and so we would back off. And that's not the issue. The issue is what happens if the economy is still awful and prices start rising like crazy. This whole thing is annoying to me because when I used to teach undergrad, one of the things I taught in the macro principles class was that the original orthodox Keynesian view of the 50s and the 60s had a very naive Phillips curve that said there's a trade-off between unemployment and inflation, and they thought the policymakers would deal with one evil or the other. That, yeah, if you had high price inflation, at least you had full employment, and if you wanted to combat the price inflation, you could raise interest rates or raise taxes or whatever, but then that would hurt aggregate demand, so you might so that would bring down inflation, but then unemployment might go up. Or vice versa, if you had a bad labor market, you had high unemployment, you could just pumping, bump up aggregate demand. You could cut interest rates, or the government could start spending more. That would boost aggregate demand, bring down unemployment. But then once you fix that problem, if you did it too hard, then all of a sudden prices would start rising if you overdid it. All right, so that was the standard Keynesian view. And then I taught, because this is what I had learned, and I thought every free market economist agreed with this, was that in the 1970s we had stagflation, where you had high unemployment and high inflation, price inflation at the same time, and that was supposed to be impossible according to the standard Keynesian framework. And so then what was the policymaker supposed to do? Because it said, oh, when there's high inflation, you raise interest rates, but then the toolbox also said, when there's high unemployment, you cut interest rates. So what was the policymaker supposed to do? And then, the critiques of the Phillips curve that Milton Friedman and other free market guys had advanced really, I thought, took hold in the 1970s because people saw with their own eyes. This isn't just theory. These free market guys are right. This Keynesian stuff's crazy. It doesn't work. It doesn't explain what we're in right now, and it doesn't give us a solution. So I thought that was standard practice or standard belief among free market economists, and I taught that yes, the 70s experience of stagflation showed that it's wrong when Keynesians argue that high unemployment it gives you protection from price inflation. And yet, not only are the Keynesians saying that now, but even free market people are talking like that. So I don't, no, they're not calling Bernanke when he says we don't need to worry right now about inflation because there's so much slack in the economy. Well, I mean, that's different words, but he's basically saying you can't have stagflation. So, if they want to explain what's different about the economy right now from the 70s, and that's why we had stagflation back then, but we can't have it now, okay, I'm open to that, but they don't even say that. They just say, everybody knows if resources aren't fully employed, then you can't have rising prices. And again, I thought that's what the 1970s was a counterexample to, that very mentality. So yes, Benjamin, I think Bernanke is bluffing. I'll be very surprised to see that if he takes contractionary measures that would crash the economy. In particular, I'm going to be very amazed if Bernanke does things that would hurt the financial sector. I don't think Ben Bernanke stays up at night worrying about unemployment. I don't think he's doing his best to get jobs for minority teenagers in the inner cities. I don't think that's what Bernanke's doing in his job. So would he do things that would make the unemployment rate go up? Sure, why not? But would he do stuff that would make all the banks go under? No, I don't believe that for a second. I think he would destroy the dollar before he did that. And then I think the people in the banking sector know that, and they would position themselves first. Right? So that's the thing. If my black helicopter type scenario came true and they were going to just let the dollar implode, then obviously the people who were going to benefit from that in the long term would also in the short term benefit from that because they would know it was coming. They would position themselves accordingly. They'd go long gold and silver, and they would short treasuries, and they would do all kinds of, go long commodities, that kind of stuff. Okay, Lewis says, any thoughts on the Republican debate last Monday in New Hampshire? No, I didn't see it. I was in Auburn teaching at the Rothbard Graduate Seminar. Benjamin says, can you give us a preview of what your Keynes, Krugman, the Crisis course will cover? How much reading will be required? Well, you can see the only readings that we don't have up there in the syllabus are the ones for the first 2 weeks because I have to get a copy of the general theory and just go through that and pick which ones. Because the copy I have, it's buried in my book somewhere. I don't know where it is. I think I just have to order a new copy. So you can see for weeks 3 through 8 what the readings would be already if you go to the thing. If you're asking about weeks 1 and 2, I'm not sure because I kind of need to look at it again to see to remind myself of how hard it was, because I taught parts of the general theory, Keynes' general theory, to my history of economic thought class. So I've taught from it before, and it was it's hard. How can I put it? It's hard to cut it off so that there's enough that you can get the context of what he's saying, but yet it's not way too much to be digestible. So it's off the top of my head, I don't remember. It's not going to be a ton of reading, I'll put it that way. But it'll. I think the problem would be the issue would be, would you understand it? It's not going to be so much, oh my gosh, I don't have time to get through this much reading. It's going to be more, we're supposed to read these, whatever, 40 pages from Keynes this week, and I don't know what the heck he's talking about, and so it's hard for me to slug through this. That would be the issue. So I'm not going to assign so much reading that you don't have time to do it. It's just, it might be difficult reading, and I can't remember off the top of my head how bad it was. Because I'm not trying to scare you, I actually think the general theory is fairly readable. But a lot of people say that book is incomprehensible and don't even try to read it. And I read it waiting for it to get really hard, and it never did. You know, I closed the closed the back cover of the book thinking, when was it supposed to get hard? This was fine. I knew what he was talking about. So I'm not trying to scare you away. I'm just saying if there is an issue, I think some people are going to say this is hard. I don't know what he's talking about. And so it might be hard for you to motivate yourself to read 20 pages if you just are lost. So obviously the point of the course is for me to guide you through it and teach you and tell you this is what he means right here so you can see it. But anyway, I don't want to say a specific number, like I just threw out 40 pages. Is it going to be 40 pages a week? I don't know. And if it were, it would just be for those first 2 weeks. Like I said, you can see the readings from week 3 through 8 that are already posted. And the only thing we are going to be reading for those first 2 weeks is from Keynes' own book. So we're not going to supplement it with like Henry Hazlitt's critique or anything, just because I don't want to overload people with the reading. So that's, I guess that's my sort of general answer. If you guys have more questions, by all means post them, but until someone does that, let me just elaborate a little bit more on my response there. So in the course, what we're going to do is I really want, how can I put it? I don't want the people taking the course to have to rely on somebody else to tell them this is what King said or that this is what Krugman said. I want you to see their own expositions in their own words so you personally will have a command of it and know this is what Keynes meant. All right. And so it's because there's a lot of not myths, but like stereotypes that have developed when people say, oh, you know, John Maynard Keynes thought that the government should always run deficits or something like that. It's kind of a caricature, but well, no, he didn't necessarily think they should always run deficits, right? It was a solution for a particular thing. And the government should run surpluses at other times to be able to afford the deficits. You know, that maybe that would be the standard Keynesian view. So that's the kind of thing we're going to look at. Or, you know, people may probably know, oh, yeah, Keynes thought the economy would just get screwed up because of animal spirits. Well, we're going to go read his discussion of that and see what exactly did Keynes say. Oh, incidentally, I just realized I was getting my weeks off. The first week is pre-Keynesian thought. So what I was referring to up till now is weeks 1 and 2. Actually, it's weeks 2 and 3 is when we cover Keynes. And so it's, if you want to see the reading, we've got the reading for week 1 and then from 4 through week 8 is already set in stone. And so the only thing that's to be determined is, I think, weeks 2 and 3. And we're doing a similar thing in that first week, reading from J.B. Say and his treatise on political economy. Because people, when it comes to Keynes and his critique of what he called the classical approach for the classical economists, one of the central elements there was what's called Say's Law after J.B. Say. and the very short version of that, people say, oh, supply creates its own demand. And on the face of it, that's clearly wrong, right? If I go produce a supply of rocking chairs that have shards of glass sticking out of it, nobody's going to want to buy those, right? So at its most elementary, superficial level, if Say's law says supply creates its own demand, then Say's law is obviously wrong. But that's not, you know, J.B. Say never wrote supply creates its own demand. That was what somebody said after the fact to try to summarize it. And so what we'll do is go back and read Say's own exposition of that to understand this was the classical understanding of why you couldn't have a general glut. Because that's what Say was getting at, is he was saying ultimately the way somebody demands commodities is by producing his own commodities in exchange. So if you're what he was criticizing is the view that we're in a recession because there's not enough money, or there's just not enough purchasing power, or there's not enough demand. All right, and so Say was trying to show that, no, that doesn't really make sense, that in an economy, ultimately, even though, yeah, the baker buys products and demands products from the cobbler, so, you know, he wants to get him to repair his shoes, and he pays him with money, that's true, but Say says, but where does the baker get the money? Well, because before that episode, he must have created bread and sold it for the money. So he's saying, ultimately, how is the baker getting the wherewithal to demand services from the shoe cobbler? It's by creating bread that people value. And so that's how he does it. So that's why Say thought that, in one sense, there could never be a general overproduction of commodities, which would be the flip side of saying there couldn't be a general dearness of money. There couldn't be a shortage of money, and oh man, if we only had more money to go around, then there'd be enough spending to employ everybody. Say thought that was crazy. All right, and so we'll, and yet that is the Keynesian diagnosis of what happens when an economy can get stuck in a bad recession. All right, so we'll look through that. But as you can see, it's a lot more sophisticated than saying supply creates its own demand. Which, incidentally, that's not what Keynes said in the general theory either. Okay, so it's sort of like a caricature on both sides. That what Keynes was attacking as Say's law was a certain claim that we need to read it in Keynes and the original thing that Keynes wrote to get the context, and then we can see is that really what Say was arguing. And then we're also going to, in that first week, read from one of the final chapters in Lionel Robbins' book on the Great Depression, because there Robbins says, you know, what should be done, because he spends most of the time up to that point in the book explaining why are we in this depression, because it came out in 1934, I believe. So, you know, that was, he'd already seen firsthand the depth of what we now call the Great Depression. And so he was explaining what happened, and it was a very Austrian-type explanation that he gave. And then, so he's saying near the end of his book, okay, so what should policymakers do now if what I've said is right? And he lays it out. So the reason I included that is you can see it wasn't at all, the standard way you learn history now, or history of economic thought, people will say basically, yep, the classical economists developed theories about free trade and so forth, and the division of labor, and that was great, and it was generally laissez-faire, and we had the international gold standard, and countries were prosperous, blah, blah, blah. And then the Great Depression came along and upset economists' faith in, you know, the equilibrating tendencies of the unfettered market or something like that, or their theories were found wanting, and free market economists could not explain the depth and severity of the Great Depression. And hence, John Maynard Keynes, you know, had a window to come in and offer his general theory. And that's, and so that's, so somebody who's sympathetic to Keynesian thought, that's the explanation they'll give as to why Keynesian thoughts supplanted the earlier schools that were in place or doctrines that were in place. It's going to say those doctrines weren't working. The free market had done okay up till then, but no, the free market and the gold standard were doing miserably in the 30s. And so since the free market economists had been discredited, people gave Keynes a shot. No, he got us out of the Depression. Great. So to combat that inaccuracy, we're going to look at Lionel Robbins' book from 1934, because we'll see. It's not that Robbins is walking around saying, oh my gosh, the free market's not working, I don't get it. No, he pointed to what was happening that was different from prior crises and why this one was so awful. It wasn't because all of a sudden the market wasn't working. It was the opposite. It was that the governments were taking unprecedented measures and the central banks were doing unprecedented things in this crisis that they hadn't done previously, and that's why this crisis was lasting so long. And then, of course, his solutions were stop this newfangled stuff. Do what we used to do that always worked before. Why are you doing this crazy new stuff? And the crazy new stuff was now what we would call Keynesianism. Okay, Benjamin says, would Keynes approve of what Bernanke is doing? Well, see, that's a good question, and I'm going to not answer it because I want to reread the general theory before I say that, before I say what my answer is, right? So that's exactly, I'm not trying to be coy with you, but that's exactly the kind of thing that this course is going to equip us to answer. So, I mean, I have read the general theory before, so I could give a decent answer right now, but since I'm going to read it again in a week or two, I'll hold off on that because I'm sure I'm going to be much better informed, refresh my memory as to what Keynes himself said. Because the problem is there's a difference between John Maynard Keynes and his disciples, Keynesians. And there's even a tradition of inquiry within history of economic thought to say, was Keynes a Keynesian? Meaning, did John Maynard Keynes himself subscribe to the school or to the doctrines that we now refer to as Keynesian analysis and policy recommendations, because the general theory obviously was much more nuanced than just drawing a few curves and saying this is what should happen when there's a shortfall in aggregate demand. And incidentally, that's another issue that people might not know. The general theory contains one diagram, and even that diagram is not a Keynesian diagram. It's a diagram of the loanable funds market that Keynes says, just to be clear, I don't believe in this, or that's what I'm throwing out. Okay, so there's if you think of Keynesian economics as a bunch of diagrams, realize that that's not in the general theory. It was the popularizers of Keynes's thought that tried to codify into those, ISLM curves and stuff like that. So, but would he approve, Benjamin? Well, I certainly think he would have said that the Fed needs to do something and not just sit back and watch the economy suffer. But part of what the issue with the Keynesians in those days was is that they were talking about the limits of conventional monetary policy. Okay, so, there's the famous idea of pushing on a string where, you can get stuck in a liquidity trap and then the central bank is sort of helpless to do anything because, just because of the, so anyway, I'm sort of getting ahead of myself, but my point is it's a very interesting question, and we can go look and see in the general theory. If the question is, the guy who wrote the general theory at that moment in time, what would he have approved of what Bernanke is doing now? And it's hard to say because, again, he would have liked there to be an activist Fed, no doubt, but would he have approved of the particular things Bernanke is doing? That's a much harder question to answer. Benjamin says, are you planning on hosting office hours for your next two courses? Yes. Yeah, every time I do a Mises Academy class, I'll have office hours. You know, at least try to. Like if I'm out of town or something, I might miss it a week, but the general rule will be have office hours. We probably got time for one more question if you guys got one. Got about 3 minutes left. Well, if you guys don't have anything else, I guess we can end 2 minutes early. All right, thanks for tuning in, guys, and I will send out an email talking about the final exam once I have it written and I know exactly what the details are going to be. Other than that, I hope you guys liked the class, and maybe I'll see you in a future one.